I added one more podcast to the giant podcast bin. Now you have plucked that podcast out and started listening.
I took my microphone and found some human folk. Then I recorded all the noises while we spoke.
My name is Adam Buxton,
I'm a man. I want you to enjoy this, that's the plan.
Rosie, come on, should we go for a walk?
Come on. Oh, it's a fly past. Beautiful.
Let's have a little bit of music for our walk. Love it. I love a bit of Florence Eastern singing Robert Burns on a summery morning walk. How you doing, podcats? Adam Buxton here. Hey, thanks so much for joining me for podcast episode 101. This one features a rambly conversation with Sarah Pascoe and Richard Iowade, two comedians who are both avid readers and have both written books, which is why I thought they might be well suited to talk with me about The Catcher in the Rye by J.D. Salinger. So this is a slightly unusual episode in that we just focus on that one theme for the whole conversation. It's kind of a book club, I suppose, is what it is. It's by no means a definitive critical analysis of The Catcher in the Rye. It's just three friends bollocking on about it. I chose Catcher in the Rye because I discovered last year when I was talking to Richard that it was his favourite book when he was a young teen. And that made me go back and reread it for the first time since school. And I thought it would be fun to talk to Richard and Sarah about the book's themes of grief and lost innocence and the pain of transitioning into the adult world and all its phoniness, as well as talking a bit about Catcher in the Rye's legendarily reclusive author, Jerome David Salinger, who died in 2010, aged 91. Now, I certainly wouldn't recommend listening to this if you haven't read Catcher in the Rye, but if you have read it, but not for a while, here's a brief synopsis. Catcher in the Rye, published in 1951, begins with 17-year-old Holden Caulfield recuperating following a breakdown. The rest of the book is an account from Holden's point of view of the events that led to that breakdown, which took place the previous winter in the days following his expulsion from Pensey Prep, a private school. Holden's roommate at Pensey is a meathead called Stradlater. Stradlater? Stradlater. Who informs Holden of his sexy plans for Jean Gallagher, a childhood friend of Holden's who he feels particularly protective of. A fight ensues, after which Holden spends 2 days killing time in New York before he has to face his parents and inform them of his expulsion from Pensey. We learn that things have been difficult for Holden since the death of his younger brother, Ali, when Holden was just 13. Ali had a baseball glove on which he had written poems to read during boring baseball games. Now Holden entertains hopes of moving in with his older brother, D.B., a World War II vet who's become a successful screenwriter in Hollywood. He probably wrote Long Shot, starring Charlize Theron and Seth Rogen. During his visit to New York, a lonely Holden visits a jazz club. I'm going for jazz club. And spends much of his remaining cash buying drinks for three older women with whom he flirts half-heartedly. After which he arranges an abortive liaison with Sunny, a teenage prostitute, and falls foul of her thuggish pimp, Maurice, in a depressing hotel room. Later, Holden arranges a meeting with an old girlfriend, Sally Hayes, and is briefly looked after by a well-meaning teacher, Mr. Antolini. But Mr. Antolini's affections at one point are interpreted as predatory by Holden, who ends up distraught and emotional, creeping into his parents' house to see the only person in the world that he feels he can really talk to, his little sister Phoebe. So there you go. That's a sort of overview. I've missed out lots of bits, obviously, but I'm assuming that you've read it, and hopefully recently. Obviously, there's an awful lot to be said about the book and its author, and I've put a few links to a couple of documentaries and articles that I found particularly interesting in the description of this podcast. But right now, let's get into some Catcher in the Rye chat with Sarah Pascoe and Richard Iowadi. Here we go. Thank you very much for coming along to In Our Time with me, Melvin Bragg.
Yeah.
That's what Richard was worried this was going to be like.
Yeah, I know. I saw in the email.
Or hopeful
you said,
that it would be.
Yeah.
Secretly hopeful.
Richard was thinking this was going to be some sort of thorough dissection of Catcher in the Rye, put in historical context.
Historical context would be interesting. Have you reread it in preparation for the book club?
Yes.
Yes. So did I.
Yes.
So already
like
we've done quite a lot of work.
There's been many readings before. It's always good to say that you've reread something.
Well, sometimes if it's a long time ago, you forget. You know, especially with classics, you just say, yeah, read that. Hamlet all over.
When did you read it first?
Well, I think I read it as a teenager. But then I think I did, but I misremembered the ending, which now makes me doubt it.
Okay, what did you remember the ending as being?
I thought he died.
Oh, you thought he killed himself?
Yeah, I thought it was a suicide book.
Oh. Hmm. Were you made to read it at school originally, or did you just read it?
No, it wasn't on the syllabus. I think someone else referenced it in a way that kind of teenagers who are very rebellious loved this book. And I thought, I'm a teenager who's very rebellious. I'll love this book. And then I think how I remember it is that I read it, didn't particularly enjoy it, and thought, oh, it must be for boys then. Must be a boys book, which I did not feel this time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
I'm really glad I reread it.
Yeah. We're going to come back to that, Sarah.
Thanks,
and when did you first read it, Richard?
Probably teens, early teens. A teacher gave it to me to read.
Oh, okay. Because he thought you were an intelligent young man and he wanted to cultivate your potential.
I don't know. He had very long feet. He had his shoes specially made. They were narrow and long. He wasn't tall. I'd say 5'4", but size 9 feet. Oh. And I remember this.
And was so it the penguin?
Yeah. He was Danny DeVito.
I was taught by Danny DeVito.
It was a bit like, yes, you might enjoy this.
Mm-hmm. But you obviously liked the teacher sufficiently to take him up on it.
Yes. It was the first book I remember really liking, I think.
And you liked it immediately, or did it sort of grow on you?
Yes, I liked it a lot immediately and then bought it, and I think I read it a fair bit.
What was it about it that sucked you in?
Well, it was funny, and I hadn't really read any book with language like that that was so personal, so I guess just in an argo. Also, I think at that age, America was just the most exciting prospect. Nirvana, Bill Hicks, Tarantino, it just seemed very exciting, America, and that sort of romance of New York.
It is very grown up. Like, he does kind of leave school and have like a little bit of money and go to a bar. And even though there's all these restrictions to it, he's kind of like in taxi cabs and going around the town, even though he's a child.
Mm.
Yeah. And his parents don't know where he is.
Yeah. So the book was published in 51. And so this is the New York of the late 40s, early 50s. And yeah, there is just an atmosphere of adults talking to younger people like their peers almost.
One of the many tragedies of the book is him misreading the teacher's affection when he stays around his house. I found that so sad.
Mm.
And you can just feel there's all this kind of sadness because men have been boys and they reflect back on this kind of period of frustration on not knowing or not being able to deal with the amount of emotion that you can have in a body. And so that teacher kind of just stroking his head in the night and him assuming, well, okay, I need to leave, there's something weird going on. It just felt like a drunk man. The affection.
Right. Mr. Antolini.
When you read it originally, because I was made to read it at school.
So you were made to, so it was syllabus.
Yeah,
it was syllabus. And you had to kind of write things about it or talk about it.
Write an essay in the style of Holden Caulfield.
That's so ironic because he writes essays for other people in the book. In their style.
When he's at boarding school. So I could sort of ape the style, but I didn't get beneath the surface at all. I didn't know what it was about. I didn't get it.
It's such a clever thing that it does, because it never, ever tells you what's going on. You have to know enough to understand two people's point of view and why they misunderstand each other at every instance, because the narrator doesn't tell you.
Yeah.
No. Or almost immediately says, I'm not going to tell you a load of things, and then reveals them. You know, like it starts with him saying, you know, my parents would have, is it two heart attacks apiece or something, if I told you anything too personal. Yeah. And the things he says are so personal throughout, and amazingly so. It combines sadness and funniness to such an extreme, and an innocence. And each chapter's like a short story. Mm. It feels that everything has like a tremendous cliffhanger. Nothing seems to hugely happen. It's just it's a kind of lost weekend in a way.
Yeah. I found a lot of moments really painful.
Which
the
ones?
The women in the bar who are kind of using him for drinks.
Yeah.
I found it excruciating. I was so angry with everyone.
Yeah, that bit made an impression on me when I was reading it first time around. Mm. I found the whole thing so depressing as a teenager.
Yeah, so his rant about actors is my favourite thing. I mean, obviously the repetition of phony about anything, but the ultimate phoniness is people who are phony for a living. It's just, it's absolutely glorious. And then being there with someone else who clearly likes another guy, and her and this man are loving the play and loving it. He's just standing there chain smoking, hating everything.
That's the thing that got through to me as when I first read it. Was like, oh, yeah, I get the concept of phonies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think I do. What were the phonies to you, though, Richard, when you read it?
Well, it was hard to know. I just really liked him. I just really liked being in the company of this voice. And probably now I am aware more reading it how young he is and damaged. But he still felt damaged and not right about things, but he just seemed very happy to give everything the absolute evisceration, and that just seemed funny. I mean, the phoniness of it, I guess it's the same things like assemblies and long assemblies about the dangers of acorns and you know, being lost property and people having to go up to collect pants with skids in and that being kind of shown in front of everyone. And saying how important this school was, and
these are all things that happened to you.
Yeah, I was that child. No, but just things like the Christmas. I remember the Christmas description in the book about them throwing snowballs, and I went to a Catholic school, and they'd have a, you know, Christmas mass, and the feeling of that, and people singing "Come All Ye Faithful" and trying to get away with singing the last "Oh Come Let Us Adore Him" as loudly and as aggressively as possible. Because you couldn't get in trouble, because that's what you're meant to do. But
you want
everyone,
God to hear you.
Everyone knows this isn't right, but they can't. How do they tell you off for it? Those sort of things, which I feel it's really good on. And just, I don't know, just the hovering of boys and just everyone's preening and things that happen. So I don't know, phoniness was just probably at that age, it's everyone who isn't you, really.
It's so connected to pretension and status, because phonies are never inferior. It's someone who behaves like they're better than you. An actor, that's what the whole thing, like the ultimate, just because they're on stage, they think they're better than you.
Yeah.
And that's sometimes with the phoniness, there was an assumption on his behalf that they think they're better than me because I'm in the audience watching them.
Yeah. And but also it feels like it's a preemptive strike on rejection. So people are phony because there's a superficial attraction to that world. He still goes to the movies. He loves pretending to be an actor and all the stuff of him pretending that he's bleeding and just got shot and his tap dancing. So it's a kind of, you're attracted by that world, feel that it may not quite accept you. Mm. So you dump them before they dump you by just going, I just don't even want to be involved with this. It's just so gross. But you're kind of fascinated by it as well.
Yeah, which is the thing with the visiting the sex worker.
That's a pivotal scene.
Huge. And all of this curiosity to the point of desperation about this adult world of sex.
Yeah.
And then the reality of it, especially the reality of buying it.
Mm.
So a situation without any intimacy and then having to try and back out of that, and then the awful thing of just then you're a boy, this now suddenly you're a little boy and they're going to steal from you and there's nothing you can do. And like that, again, in terms of like cringing moments, I was so angry on his behalf. It's just so infuriated because you can, you can feel that anger. You just explode. The world is so unfair already, and now this is happening.
Had you started to have those kind of moments of transitioning into the adult world and leaving behind innocence and that weird, sleazy hotel on your own feeling that he so brilliantly encapsulates in that scene? Had you had those sort of experiences when you read the book?
I don't think I had that kind of segue into adulthood. Interestingly for myself, he's a very rich person. So when I was 16, 17, 18, all of my desperation for freedom involved just wanting some money. Mm-hmm. Like, and I did work, but I didn't ever have enough money to be able to make any choices. And then I started properly working when I was 18. And then you do have a small amount of money. So I think I went straight from absolutely no freedom to now I have absolute freedom. So definitely read it the first side and didn't understand any of that. He seemed like a very rich boy.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Privileged. Mm. And were you playing at being a grown up at a certain point, Richard? And
no.
Smoking cigars and dressing in suits and going and hanging out in jazz clubs?
I was dressing in suits, sure. I wasn't an animal.
Yeah.
But no, I was in no way in an adult world. Yeah, I had zero freedom. I guess maybe I was 13 when I read it or 14.
Yeah. So oh, really? Very young.
Yeah, I wasn't involved in anything. I mean,
what did
I
you make at that age of the of that scene with the prostitute then? Do you remember? Just thought, what the hell's this?
It just felt like he's out of his depth all the way through.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the language is so brilliantly simple, but, you know, also sophisticated, and just the repetition as well, which is so cleverly done, of just saying the same things again, of just not worrying about using the word phony three times in the same paragraph, as which you feel would be more writerly to not, you know, stack things with the same adjectives. That it felt, oh, I can follow him doing anything because he's using a level of language that I can comprehend. But the actual emotion of what that would feel like, I couldn't go, oh, well, if I were in a situation with it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think, but...
Yeah, it's incredibly readable, isn't it? It's so easy to read.
Yeah.
It's just beautifully smooth and none of it jars none of it is.
Well, that's what's so amazing about J.D. Salinger is actually that he isn't an author who's published lots and lots of books.
No.
And I think that's why people get so obsessed with this book and him, is that he was a hermit who didn't answer any questions or explain himself anything more than the text and then just stopped writing.
Mm.
Or did he?
Or
well,
did
that's
he?
The thing,
that's
yeah.
Right.
The vault.
There's supposed to be a vault with unpublished manuscripts all labelled and waiting for publication. Although I also read that after one of his former lovers, Joyce Maynard, published a kind of tell-all memoir, and then also one of his daughters, Margaret, in 2000, published a book as well that was quite an evisceration.
Dreamcatcher.
That both of those encouraged him, supposedly, to just burn everything.
Oh, really? Because that's the thing, is it would be odd to want to be published, but not while you were alive.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of one or the other, isn't it? You kind of think, this is never for anyone, or I don't want to be here.
Although, supposedly, he left instructions of certain stories that can be published this far after his death, but they may be ones that were previously available.
Yeah,
because the collection of 9 stories doesn't collect a lot of his early stories, which he didn't seem to think were up to much or up to his standards.
Yeah.
And then Hatworth, is it 24, that one, Hatworth 16, 1924, that came out in the New Yorker in 1965, you can't get, and maybe that can come out later, or there's stipulations in his sort of will and things.
And do they not just exist online?
They're really hard to find online. Really? I think it's pretty well policed, the Salinger estate.
And who does run the estate, do you know?
His son. And his last wife.
Okay.
It's always a good phrase. My last wife.
Yeah.
My most recent wife.
One of the theories was that he was writing under a different name.
Oh, Pynchon.
Thomas Pynchon, yes. Yeah,
that Salinger was Pynchon.
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
I hadn't heard that
before. That was the first time I really read anything biographical about Salinger, was that someone had gone to interview Pynchon and he ran out of the window of the house.
Right.
and they said, oh, it's J.D. Salinger.
Well, the styles are not similar, but are they just similar kind of literary figures?
And I mean, Salinger's a sort of publicity kind of monger compared to Pynchon. It's maybe one picture of Pynchon or two, no interviews.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's fun going down the Catcher in the Rye Salinger rabbit hole because there's so much there to think about and read about, because he was such a mysterious figure, and he now is, you know, with modern sensibilities, he is a controversial figure. He was involved almost exclusively with young women. He got into relationships when these women were in their teens. Pretty much all the women that he had long-term relationships with, he met when they were very young. What is it? I came across this article online that is illustrative of the attitude some people have about him.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very difficult, that thing, culturally. It's called hebephilia, and it's an attraction to women who are adolescent but at a very early stage.
Right.
And actually, it's very common in men with high status. Like, it happens a lot with music. And that's the thing, is that there's been such a cultural shift in understanding power and economic dynamics and what a relationship ideally should be between equals, and a 13 or a 14-year-old can't be the equal of an older man who's especially a rock star or an established writer. But it is really common. It's a very, very common thing.
Yeah.
And especially it's very difficult to look back on the past and then go, well, this is my diagnosis. That person was doing this or was abusing a power relationship.
Right. Here's this article. Just an example of the kind of thing. J.D. Salinger was a shockingly creepy womanizer who took home underage girls into his 60s. And then series of...
Into his 60s.
Yeah.
He had a 60s room.
But that's the thing. Had to dress like Austin Powers. People who... this is why it's very connected to people who are artists and powerful, is that quite often people don't stop who they're attracted to. And of course, that makes perfect evolutionary sense. Men can continue to have children and to be attracted to very fertile women. There's a biological argument that makes complete sense, and lots of artists throughout history, the people that we know about, is exactly that story. It is exactly that story.
Well, Chaplin, who married Una O'Neill, who was one of Salinger's first girlfriends, was 53 when they married. She was 18. I think they married on her 18th birthday. And they had eight children. And, you know, that's meant to be one of the kind of armchair psychological analyses of Salinger, that he was continually trying to recreate this perfect prelapsarian relationship that he had with Una O'Neill before he went to the war and could never get over it. And then her to this, to essentially the most famous man in the world. Is enough to give you quite a distaste for movie phoniness and the power of that. And, you know, your first love.
Right. And then coming back from World War II, after spending almost like D-Day, he was out there until Armistice Day and liberating death camps at the end of it, having seen horrible things, terrible fighting, and presumably traumatized by that. And then coming out of it, found out while he was in France fighting that Una had gone off with Charlie Chaplin, married Charlie Chaplin. So for all sorts of reasons, he finishes the Second World War absolutely heartbroken and very cynical about humanity.
He was hospitalized for a breakdown.
Right, okay.
And also this very strange thing where he marries a German former member of the Nazi Party, which is a... You know,
he himself is Jewish.
Half Jewish. Well, his mother wasn't. His mother was, I think, Irish Catholic.
Okay.
His father was Jewish.
Yeah.
You could go to jail for marrying a former Nazi collaborator at that. And she came to America, and then it was annulled very soon.
It's still frowned upon to marry a Nazi in some places.
Please. How do we have a royal family? Please. Stop it. Is this on? Please. I'm here all week. I think it's. I think we're cool with Nazis now, aren't we? We've got over
live
that.
Let live.
Everyone's entitled to their ideological to structure, their
flags, and hats.
Nazi's just a label. For me, it's a lifestyle. You want to call it Nazi? How I live? That's cool. I don't call it. I just call it rigorous. It's a thorough way of life for me.
But. Yeah, so there's all sorts of things which are just begging to be analysed.
Yes.
And the most obvious theory seems to be that Salinger is just trying to, he's determined to preserve in everyone he sees some sort of concept of innocence. So the reason I wanted to have this conversation with you guys was that I read the book again recently, having not read it since I was 15 or something, having kind of written it off, I was like, oh, it's not that great. Yeah. People go on about this book, but it's a sort of a cliche of a great book. It's really not all that. I don't think my dad liked it. I remember at the time when I was reading it, I was saying, oh, we're reading Catcher in the Rye. And he's like, oh, what do you think of that? And I said, no, I don't really get it. And he's like, no, it's rubbish. So he wasn't into it. And I thought, okay, that's fine. If dad doesn't like it, I'll just ignore it. And, you know, he didn't get the fact, obviously, that I just didn't understand it, really. And then a few months ago, I read it, aged nearly 50, father of three, with teenage sons. My eldest son is the same age as sort of the Holden character. I can see him beginning to struggle with a lot of the same sort of things. And obviously, it's a totally different book.
Yeah.
Suddenly, I'm understanding it on all sorts of levels and new levels that have come with being older. And also, I'm remembering with shame, cringing at lots of the scenes, because I can see that I was sort of trying to do a lot of the same things that Holden was, that having this slightly self-pitying attitude towards relationships and romance and sort of thinking, oh, I'm nice. It's a sort of thing of being sure that you know what's best for someone else and the best way to keep them innocent and to preserve what's nice about them and to rail against anyone.
It's trying to control people a little bit,
it's a form of control, I suppose,
This isn't related to you, but more related to an extreme version of Holden Caulfield, and it's really interesting, obviously, the murderers that have really loved Catcher in the Rye, it's really spoken to them.
Yeah, Chapman, who killed John Lennon, and then the Reagan,
that was
Hinckley.
Yeah, yeah.
And then one other?
There was one, and he was obsessed with a young actress who rejected him, and he sent her lots and lots of letters that they found afterwards, and then he followed her onto a set in LA. And again, and he found out that Mark Chapman had the book, and that's why he took it.
Oh, yes, Robert John Bardo was carrying a copy of the book the night he murdered the actress Rebecca Schaffer.
Sorry, I should have remembered her name. Yeah, Rebecca Schaffer. I'm trying to think what's one of their names. Elliot is one of them. Elliot Rogers. So do you remember this killing? Well, it's mass murder. So maybe 2 years ago. And he recorded long YouTube videos. And basically he was saying, I'm such a nice guy. I am so handsome. I am so great. I've got this car. And yet women continue to give their sex to other men. He felt so entitled. But there's this very subtle thing that's in The Catcher in the Rye that obviously hardens in certain men. And actually you see it a lot in the worst parts of the internet, where the men who are very angry with certain women. And again, it's that assumed rejection, or they've had other rejections. And it's like, I am one of the... Why do they continue to go out with these horrible men? Why do girls like bad guys? And actually, they don't, really. It's one of those myths that guys who aren't very nice tell themselves they are not getting things because they're too great.
Yeah.
Which is a wonderful narrative. But, like, that's what they've told themselves.
But when you're a teenage boy and you're seeing the most beautiful girl... What are you saying?
Why are you looking at me when you say that? When you were still a teenage boy.
When you're a boy, man.
Yeah, thanks.
When you are a teenage boy, though, and the most beautiful girl in the school is definitely not ever going to give you the time of day and is going out with some guy who's 5 years older and has a car.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to not make those assumptions that that's the way the world works.
I think what I should have stressed is that I really understand that frustration in its beginning, that the frustration of it and the unfairness of the world. In a way, there's a reversal, actually. I think being a boy at school where the girls that you'd like to kiss are going with older guys with cars is then reversed when you're a slightly older woman and the guys you like are going for much younger women and picking them up with their cars. There is a dissonance, isn't there? I think the thing that I feel so sad about, something I've only recently become interested in the last couple of years, is actually how... Oh, someone ringing.
That's a Salinger estate.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, this is the Salinger Estate. You don't have permission for this podcast. Also, it's very unfocused. You're just drifting randomly through. Don't you have any questions, like, to give it some structure? Have you heard In Our Time with Melvin Bragg? That's more the approach that perhaps you should be taking.
I think it's Richard's agent. Go, you just say you were a Nazi over and over again. Can you just stress?
Yeah, fine. Can you develop that?
But you were a little bit worried about the funny riff you went on about the Nazis.
Yeah.
For a while, you were sort of modelling yourself on Holden Caulfield. I think I remember you telling me.
Well, I got a hat. I did get a hat, and I got the baseball glove.
You got the hunting cap.
Yes. I couldn't find a red army hat or hunting cap, so I got a terrible army surplus cap. And then I got a baseball glove, which took forever. I asked for it for my birthday. No one played baseball. I was quite isolated.
What's the significance of the baseball glove in the book?
His brother.
Yes, his brother Ali writes on the baseball glove poems, which he reads when there's nothing to do in the outfield, and he writes them in green ink. And so I had the baseball glove.
Did you write poems on there?
Of course.
Yeah.
I saw it through.
Original poetry?
Oh, no. No, it was a bit of Shelley and
some Pam Ayres on the back.
A bit of Pam Ayres and then just, you know, limericks. There was a young girl for... Yeah, no, I think it was... Oh, yeah, oh, good grief. But it was... Yeah, I mean, I really went for it.
Yeah.
But no, it was really private. It wasn't like I was going, hey, everyone, look at my catcher in the Rye glove. It was just, I don't know, I really got into it.
Did you have any pals who were into it that you could debrief?
I could have stopped you after pals. No, the answer to that is no. No one who gets a catcher in the Rye glove and writes on it in green ink is drowning in friends.
The people who would like this book, they would love it because it resonates with isolation, not because everyone in my gang feels exactly like this.
Yeah, me and the guys, whenever we went down the Waffle House.
Yeah.
Dude, let's get together and talk about Catcher in the Rye again tonight.
Yeah, Rye party.
Exactly. Yeah,
let's do shots and talk about Holden.
So obviously this is a book that is still a set text for many students. I wonder, is it? Yeah, I think it is.
Well, do you know what? I'm completely unqualified.
I'm going to stick my neck out and say that this is a book that is still a set text.
I think it's still a GCSE text. Doing well.
For many students. I mean, that's partly because it hasn't dated all that badly. There's not too many overtly sexist, racist, otherwise offensive bits of... I mean, you know, there's stuff that skirts around those areas.
Yes,
but Holden himself
absolutely
seems like, broadly speaking, a good guy.
I think also topic-wise, for such a perfect book, my sister's an English teacher, and that's the kind of book she's looking for. As an English teacher, you're teaching people about books, but you also, ideally, they're all very romantic. You want to teach them about the world. And I think because it circles around those things exactly as you said, and also you want a student to have a personal attachment when they do write their coursework and things. But I think that the unfortunate irony is that everyone hates the books they're made to read at school.
That's the thing. I mean, it was really such a shame for me because now I'm thinking, gosh, I wish my teenage son would read it because I think he'd get so much out of it. But there's just no way he's not going
to
have it.
Another parent, a mother, told me that if she wants her daughters to read something, says it's too grown up for them and they mustn't.
Yeah.
The top shelf school of parenting.
So just says, when you're a bit older, this you might, but I think at the moment too young, very adult themes in there.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, it is a gamble because with the best will in the world, you might just not like it. I found it very depressing when I read it the first time round. And I think the reason was that my parents were insulating me as much as they could from the adult world, trying to preserve my bubble of innocence.
Yeah.
And here was a book that was trampling all over that, that was all about someone making the transition and being frightened at the prospect of joining the phoniness and the ludicrousness and the, you know, nonsensical nature of the adult world. And I was rejecting it myself. I was just thinking, no, this seems awful. Depressing hotel room on his own with a prostitute and he's smoking and he's sad all the time and he's in the park and he's freezing and none of his relationships work out. And what are his parents even doing? Why aren't they there looking after him? And it was all just too much.
Well, I guess that's it, actually. It's a completely structureless life. He leaves all of the structure, doesn't have a definition of what he's going into.
You see, I didn't find the fact that what was in it could potentially be seen as depressing, or that he often talks about being depressed. I always find it really depressing if something seems to me to be rubbish, or that no one cared in the making of this, or the or writing it. And so I found it incredibly undepressing that it was so good. I find something that has an uplifting ending, which I don't like, incredibly depressing. For some reason, I always found the end of Star Wars the most depressing thing ever.
Of the first movie?
Yeah, that they do all of this stuff and then they're at this ridiculous ceremony. They just suddenly look so neat. Like, they can't be themselves. That it just felt awful. But, like, no, who wants to film this scene? This is, like, you have to give it this ending. Whereas, you know, Empire Strikes Back felt great because it wasn't a happy ending, and I found myself far less depressed at the end of that than at the end of Star Wars.
Well, that seems to me, yes. On a, here's a bit of Mickey Mouse psychology for you.
Sure.
You were not protected in the same way that I was, and so you were willing to embrace the fact that actually the big secret about life is that there isn't a big happy ending. It's all pretty messy, actually, and so you were okay embracing drama that reflected that in some way, and I just wasn't able to deal with it. I was very happy with the ceremony at the end of Star Wars.
Right.
They're getting a met. This is, they're smiling at each other. Look at R2. He's delighted.
I didn't believe it for a second. They were plastered on smiles. You could tell Harrison Ford was bored out of his head.
Oh, the ceremony. It's a very formal ceremony. But later on, they're going to just relax in the cantina and have a laugh about it all. This is the beginning of a wonderful friendship that I can't wait to see unfolding. Oh, gosh. And then, by stark contrast, at the end of Empire Strikes Back, I was like, what the shit is going... Where's Han? He's just been encased in carbonite and they're finishing the film like that? Luke's just had his hand chopped off, for crying out loud. Yes, the artificial replacement seems to be working well. Those rods are really shuffling around smoothly in his wrist there. But this is just a nightmare. So it's totally different. And I think it was just the product of me... not being emotionally ready to deal with the adult world, to deal with the reality of life after you're a child. It's heartbreaking. And the thing I was talking about being, I think, the kind of little control freak that Holden is in some ways, is that scene where he hooks up with his old girlfriend.
Yes.
What's her name?
Old Sally Hayes.
Sally Hayes. And he's just, he's kind of bottoming out. Yeah. Feeling sorry for himself, almost run out of money. He calls Sally Hayes. He thinks, oh, she'll, she likes me.
Better.
She'll turn up. He knows. He sort of abuses her affection for him. And she turns up. And then he doesn't really have any real interest in what she has to contribute. Mm. All he wants to do is dump on her this fantasy of them running off and starting a new life somewhere. Yeah. And then when she... completely reasonably raises practical objections to the plan, he gets all bent out of shape and says, screw you, you don't understand.
Yeah, all of his failure with women is because they're not real people to him yet. They're just their names, they're their face, and they're his kind of fantasy, and then they just disappoint him. Everything they say is phony or boring or wrong, and so they're not real.
Yeah, but it doesn't feel sort of unredeemable, I suppose. Because, well, I guess there are two things that feel excuse him. It's a bit like in The Graduate. You just go, this behaviour is not acceptable in someone older. But his youth is such a lens through it that, you know, he's trying to be far too adult. And it's impossible for him to do that. But his brother died when he was 13.
Yes.
And it doesn't feel like anyone is taking that into account. It doesn't feel that anyone around him... apart from Phoebe knows, we never sort of see him talk directly to his parents. There's no, it feels like they sent him to a psychiatrist for a bit. Yeah. So he's incredibly wounded and vulnerable.
Yeah, because he has a big meltdown after the brother dies.
And he smashes
all these windows in the garage and gashes his hands.
Yeah, and I suppose I feel it's important that that's a younger brother, that you'd feel somehow responsible for... someone younger than you dying. It just feels against the laws of nature. But it does also feel there's such an absence of sibling rivalry in Salinger that I find quite interesting, in that he didn't have any brothers. And I just can't imagine everyone I know with brothers, they have a lot of sibling rivalry, whereas it feels that the brothers in Salinger are kind of earlier, more perfect incarnations of himself, pre being sullied by the world. So he can love Ali because he's small and red-haired rather than tall and sort of manly and preternaturally aged or like, something like him.
Or even like just bullying him or all of those things that happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like you're horrible to your siblings, really horrible.
Yeah.
Whereas he never seemed, these characters never seem to have done that to one another. It makes you incredibly vulnerable trying to connect to someone. And especially if you feel completely disinterred and shattered, the risk of showing what a mess you are to people, especially in that post-war pull your socks up, he's about to go to military academy, is so terrifying that the threat and reality of rejection, of meeting a world that doesn't understand you, that just thinks you're strange, is completely paralyzing, I'd say. So that's the thing that I felt reading it completely connected to, that this is someone who is completely right emotionally. He's completely honest in a certain way, as well as obfuscating certain things. But the things that he's obfuscating somehow feel less important than the truth he's excavating, I feel, to me. And that's why I feel you root for him in all of these situations where you go, why are you even agreeing to pay this sex? Why are you there? You're so flailing and no one's helping you. All people are doing is saying, what's wrong with you?
Mm-hmm.
Effectively, really. And
this is in the 40s, 50s in America. I mean, I'm sure it was the same in the UK, when people were not discussing their feelings.
No, absolutely. Well, I think that's what that book does so incredibly, is there are situations where you see both people's perspectives. So you absolutely, you're right, Holden Caulfield makes complete sense and you have sympathy for him, everything, A to B, the knock-on effect. And so the example I would give is like, so the bar where there's these three women who can drink alcohol and are allowing him to buy their drinks. And so it's a horrible situation because you absolutely understand his frustration. They're not being particularly nice to him. He dances with them and it's kind of okay. One of them's quite a good dancer, but they're more interested in famous people. But it's so deftly done that you also understand their perspective is they're just having a drink with each other. And this kid is annoying them, sitting there, one by one, of course, we'll go and have a dance with you, kind of out of like begrudgingness. He has bought us these drinks, but of course they don't like him. There's no reason
they've got
they
nothing
would
in common, exactly.
No. And he's sat himself down with them in a bar pretending, this pretense of being an adult and drinking his Coca-Colas.
Mm.
And I think that's what's so incredible, is everyone seems very reasonable.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
He doesn't sell anyone out as a writer. You know, he argues for everyone and everyone has their own voice really distinctively. And yeah, as you say, it's such a sleight of hand because it's first person narration. I mean, it's such a miracle of the alighting from one to the other, whereby this reported speech, which he's giving you, represents the other person in a way that shows him up.
It's enough information for you to always... And it is incredible writing. Freud had this thing about the subconscious and how the human brain gets pleasure when it has to do a jump on its own. He wrote about this with jokes.
Yeah.
People don't want to be told it. They want to have to work it out for themselves from that information and they get a real satisfaction. And it's, that's what I think is so incredible about this book is that even like, with the grief, that word is never used. There's some information, like you say, about the smashing up and the hands and the glove. And then the rest is omitted. So you inject it all yourself. Imagining, empathizing the realities of that life and that experience.
Yeah, and at one point he talks fairly matter-of-factly about thinking about jumping out of the window and just ending it all, but not in a sort of protracted self-pitying way.
No, and if you know he's on the precipice of, you know, at the end when he faints and he just blacks out, each moment is so charged that they're kind of elevated from these small kind of quotidian little interactions into real tests of, can I go on or not? Can I even live here? I need to run away. Yeah, there's something about him that feels that he does care about people as well as having this almost, I don't know, kind of horn dog thing of just always describing how good looking people are, whether he wants to see them.
Yeah.
Now, there's also a disgust at, is it Stradlater? I can never know how to say it.
Stradlater.
Oh, yeah.
That's how it's spelled.
The fact that he just doesn't care about anyone. He's just a machine.
Yeah.
He's just a kind of seduction machine. Part of him slightly envies that ease, but you feel he does want to connect to people.
Of course. I think that Stradlater figure represents at all stages in your life there are other people where it just life seems to be easy.
Right.
And a Stradlater, and it's obviously things that are important to Holdfield at that point, but at every point in your life there are just people you go, you just get up and you live it. and then you go to bed, and it's there's none of this.
Yeah. It's not neurotic.
Yeah,
I like your contraction of the name there, Holdfield.
Holdfield. I like to call him Holdfield to save time.
Yeah. I've just been shopping at Holdfield. They do a lot of grains and pulses.
Oh, don't you find it quite depressing at Holdfield?
No, I like it.
I always sort of think about killing myself when I first go in.
Yeah.
I don't know. It just seems a very lonely place. No one really connects there. It's full of phonies.
There's a jazz floor. There's a jazz floor. We have a whiz round with a cola.
It's true, isn't it? But those are presumably they're the phonies, aren't they? Is that a phony?
Well, the phony is a catch-all term because it just means you agitate me, I don't like you, I'm jealous of you.
Right.
Sometimes it is I see through you, but I think it's more often that agitation, I think, is the right word. Something about it makes Holden feel uncomfortable, and thus you must be a phony. It's evidential that way.
Because it would be nice to be a phony, don't you think? Like, it would be nice to be untroubled by a lot of the things that Holden is troubled by.
Yeah.
And that I think he knows that as well, because everyone must think that at some stage.
Like, do you really feel that, though?
Sometimes you do, don't you? Like, if you're really in a pickle and you're just overthinking everything so much in minute detail, relationships, tiny minutiae.
I wonder if that's a cake and eat it one. I think it's when people just go, I'd love to be religious. I'd love it. Absolutely love it.
Just easy.
Love to have that comfort.
Yeah. Well,
it's a and you go, no, it's not. Like, what, it's really hard to be religious.
I think the key to the word phony and actually the phase of his life that Holden is in is that when you're a teenager, you don't realise that absolutely everyone is exactly like you. You assume that other people are two-dimensional and it is easier. And then I think the really adult thing that happens is you realise, oh, everyone is having their own version of this. And I think that's when you have proper adult empathy.
Yes.
You realise, I'm not special, I'm not alone. I mean, you can be isolated in what you're going through, but you realise everyone has the same pain and joy and the whole spectrum of emotion. Whereas I think when you're a teenager, you can't help but think it's just you. Everyone thinks they feel more than other people.
Right. And if something is not explained to you in terms that you can immediately understand, you just dismiss it.
Yes. But I feel he says that at the end when he says, don't start thinking about people because then you'll miss them. I think he does see that in everyone. And I think that is why life's really painful for him. There's the Schopenhauer thing, thou art that, which is you seeing yourself in other people. Yes, and so, why did people try and lift the car off someone in the road and they don't know this person or risk their life is the immediate recognition that they're the same as you. I guess the catcher in the right thing, he's just localizing it to children because I think partly he feels, well, how could I save an adult? I'm not an adult. So he can save people like him.
So explain the catcher in the right thing.
Well,
what is the title about?
Well, in the book, he's speaking to Phoebe and Phoebe's saying, you don't like anything, his sister, you don't want to do anything, you think everything's terrible, what do you want to do? And he says, he talks about the poem, is it Robert Burns' poem, which he mishears because a child early was singing it, if a body catcher someone,
if a body met a body,
and
the
body met a body,
but and the meta body's the right one, but he hears this kid say catch a body, and so he said, I'd like to be I'd like to be someone who just lets the kids play in this big field of rye and there are loads of children there, and then if anyone gets too near the edge, I'll just catch them and save them,
because there's a cliff edge,
which I guess is so connected to Ali and saving his brother and also saving himself. And it seems that the thing that really redeems him is the idea that, oh, now Phoebe's going to drop out. Because at the end, Phoebe comes with her suitcase and says, I'm going to run away with you and we'll go away. And I think in that moment, he goes, no, I don't want to infect you with this. And I think that's one of the great redeeming things about him, that he doesn't want his sister to get messed up like him and have this reaction. And so, I feel the phoniness is to do with a kind of lack of truthfulness, which I guess is self-delusion, and everyone's self-deluded. I think that's the main condition of existing.
Or there's an element of stoicism, isn't there, about the condition of adulthood and the loss of innocence? You have the option to go around bleating about it the whole time if you want, to be saying to everyone, why aren't you freaking out? Yeah. We're all going to die. Yeah. It's horrible out there. It's scary. Yeah. People are phony. We're not getting on. Why is there so much misery? Or you have the option to try and make the best of it and to be stoical about it to a degree, to assume that other people are struggling with those
So if phony is not addressing the existential reality of being alive, I think the problem is that no one does that 24/7. So you might be at one moment talking about something very real,
yeah.
but the next minute Holden might hear you talking about sandwich filling and go, right, okay. These phonies at cocktail parties talking about a sandwich filling. Maybe that's the thing about being a teenager, because everything yeah. is so raw
yeah.
that you think it has to be that constantly. So we work this out.
That's right.
And then there's this next bit we go, we're not going to work it out. It's a big mystery.
You see, I feel you could be really sincere talking about sandwich fillings, and it's more just
yeah.
and
how
he
you
would
talk
he
about
would
it.
Like that. He just wouldn't like someone trying to make themselves sound great about
great.
Sandwich fillings.
Yeah, or like his new sandwich filling.
Yeah, like if someone yeah. goes, I just really love cheese. He wouldn't think that. I think it's the idea yes. of trying to impress people,
okay. right? Doing it as a pose,
or oh, coming yeah. from okay. fear. It's really difficult to not be self-deluded. It's just impossible. I mean, you see it in certain people. Often when people are older and they've got less to lose, or there's a certain... If you know you're going to die in a week, I think your self-delusion probably drops.
Right.
In a certain way.
Worry less about being eviscerated on
you,
social
you don't,
media.
You don't
you
worry about... yeah, you don't just go, oh, look at this tweet yeah. that someone sent about me. I guess it's trying to get to what is meaningful, which I suppose for someone coming out of a situation where you see the death counts first hand and just see something so terrible and hidden,
course, yeah.
that why wouldn't you be obsessed with really the necessity for people to realize how messed up they are, that people really need to engage with that, and it being urgent and not just a kind of affectation that it's like life and death.
Then Salinger's worst nightmare kind of comes true, which is that the book is a runaway sensation. Right, within a few years, it's the biggest book in the world. Everyone loves it across the world. It's gone crazy. It's never been out of print since it was published. It supposedly sells like 250,000 copies a year
yeah.
and continues to do so. Just soon after it was published, all sorts of people wanted to by the film, right?
And it's never been made
yeah.
into a film, has
no,
it?
No.
And it can't.
It can't be.
Yeah.
Why is
yeah.
that?
He's stipulated against it in his will.
Right. Billy Wilder.
Jerry
Elliot
Lewis.
Kazan, Jerry Lewis? What the hell would he have done? Did he want to play
yeah,
Holden
Caulfield? Can you imagine Jerry Lewis?
No. And Leonardo DiCaprio more recent times wanted to play that part. Andrew
Ray Winstone.
Ray Winstone would have been wonderful. David Walliams, I think, would have
yep.
would have made a superb yep. Holden Caulfield.
Really good. Salinger have said the only person who could play it was him. That was supposedly yeah. the thing.
Right.
That's the thing, is it seems like he's so inextricably connected to it and
yeah.
couldn't separate it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
wouldn't want... It's difficult. And any book to a film is very, very difficult. But you're essentially widening out the amount of creatives who have a take on it. And if it's that inherently personal and specific,
yeah.
you can't allow that without ruining it.
Yes, and he was burnt by... There was an adaptation made of one of his books, which he hated.
What was that one? Was it Franny? I've only read, I think it's Franny.
It was one of his stories. Was it called My
oh, yes.
Foolish Heart? He had a real
They changed the title
that.
To Blue,
Blue
Melody.
Melody. And he freaked out.
He went yes. fucking furious.
And never spoke to his friend, who's meant to be safeguarding
yes.
that the copy was perfect. But he didn't have control over the title. And he never spoke to that
wow.
person again.
He's a control freak. So.
Yeah, wow.
But still, the phenomenon
yeah.
just gets away from him
yeah.
and immediately turns into this kind of thing where people are fascinated by him
yes.
because it seems to be so clearly autobiographical.
Yeah.
They start wanting to find out about him and his relationships and his personal life. He gets fed up and moves out to the country, to Cornish in New Hampshire, this little town, where he lived until his death in 2010, aged 91.
Yeah.
And defended his privacy
yes.
with a shotgun. Sometimes
yeah.
he would appear at the door when,
yeah.
when nutters turned up, which
yes.
they would do
like it's
regularly.
Kind of making a pilgrimage to him.
Yeah.
So this is the thing that's interesting. At university, I did an English degree, and the first term, one of the things we studied alongside postmodernism was death of the author. We were told at the beginning of university, essentially, don't get carried away about what is biographically true or where it
yeah.
comes from. You take a piece of work as a piece of work and you'll be much better at analysing it. And I went to a university that specialised in cultural materialism. And so the time that a piece was written is very, very relevant. But whether the author did go to that school or was gay isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so
And what do you feel about that?
Well, the thing is, it's intoxicating. The minute you say, oh, the war or young girlfriends, of course I want to know more, because you want to analyse them like a therapist and go now. And that must be so frustrating. Don't try and make meaning of a person via something that was also of a moment.
But there's something about it, particularly, there's a line in it when he says, if I really like a book, I just want to ring up the author and just talk to him. And he talks about maybe wanting to call up Isaac Dinesen, but not Somerset Maugham. And there is something, if you really connect to something, I don't know if you have this, if I really like something, I just want to immediately get everything. Which is a terrible, I think, just urge of just possession as well.
And you're an author. Bad things. Everyone knows. Yeah.
Terrible person. But I'll just go, okay, now I've got to get everything.
Yeah.
So I really like Mike Nichols. I have to read everything he's ever said, watch every film. And I don't know that I necessarily want to read biographies, but I somehow want
the details.
Everything they've done. And it doesn't matter if something's not so good. I just have to, I don't know, you just feel so connected to them.
Sure. Yeah, it's tempting to sort of write it off, that urge to get behind the scenes, as immaturity, I suppose. And I only say that because it's something that I'm definitely guilty of, and always have been, of being quite literal-minded and sort of wanting to know what stuff means. And now in the internet age, you can do that very easily. You just type in, what does Catcher in the Rye mean? And then you get
A whole list of stuff. Well, actually, I love that with the Childish Gambino This Is America video.
Oh, right.
That was such an amazing thing to have an internet resource to go, I know that there's all this symbolism here that I'm not qualified to read.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the fact that then you can, some other people will show you, this is that, this is that, that's a nod to this.
But those are just sort of specific details that are hidden in the background of the thing. It doesn't necessarily tell you what it means. And of course, ultimately, those are things that you need to decide for yourself.
But it's a language where suddenly you've got levels of meaning. So if I was to watch an opera, which is in Italian, and I've never seen an opera, then any meaning I'll get out of it will be arbitrary.
Right.
Yeah.
Whereas I loved that song so much in the video. And then the more I understood, the more I loved the levels and the intelligence and... So sometimes it's wonderful having things over explained.
Yeah, I mean,
to
I do like... I'm someone who watches kind of documentaries about bands that I like.
Yeah.
I like seeing how this and that song came together, but then I'll talk to other people, especially musicians, who just think that that is the saddest thing in the world. And why would you want to do that?
Yeah.
Because if any medium really can stand on its own, then it's music. And that's all you need. You've got the song.
Yeah.
Why would you want to find out about what they were doing in the studio and how the who he was going out with at the time and all this kind of crap? I'm like, I love all that stuff.
Love it.
So to bring it back to Salinger, though, he is then in this position with people just being absolutely fascinated by the details of his personal life. And then to actually have not one but three people commit murder in the name of, or at least partly.
Well, I guess that's it. He became incredibly famous. And so then had all of the terrible things that happen if you're famous and,
embraced by the
phones. But also so many people read that book. I mean, it sold so many that it's almost...
It's bound to be enjoyed by a couple of nut buckets.
Yeah. As in, if you're a serial killer and you're looking for a book to read... It's likely that's one of the ones.
Enjoyed this? Yeah. Try this.
Yeah, and your Amazon recommends.
Yeah.
Like Guns and Ammo, you may also like. But it's so good. That's the thing about Catcher in the Rye. You know, it's just so... I didn't want to find out anything about the author when I read Catcher in the Rye. I just thought, I want to read everything he's done, as in someone capable of this magic. You just would follow anything they wrote again, because it's just so... rare.
I haven't read his other books. What's and your favourite of the others?
I really like Franny.
Franny and Zooey?
Yeah, Zooey's longer and it's more to do with the brother, the Glass family, that's Franny and Zooey, who are not the youngest, but maybe they are the youngest, but Franny's the younger one and Zooey's the slightly older brother, and Zooey happens just after the end of the Franny story. And that's really beautiful. And, I mean, all of it's good. Nine stories, Franny and Zooey, which is essentially two long short stories, not quite novellas. And then Seymour, An Introduction, which was the last one, last published in book form one, which is twinned with Raise High the Roof Beams carpenters. I think they're all incredible.
Have you read any of those, Sarah?
I've read Franny and Zoe, but I think I might go and read some of the short... I'm very lazy with short stories, because actually I go, well, how good can they be? And then often it's like very, very good is the answer.
I'd say these, yeah.
Someone really had to twist my arm to read Raymond Carver.
Oh, right, yeah. Yeah, they're pretty great.
Pretty great.
Have you read No Comebacks by Jeffrey Archer? Quite a few twists.
Really good.
Blow your fucking mind in that one.
Is that a short one, is it? I've read some Archer.
Is he good?
I used to work in a hotel for older people. It's called Warner Holidays, and there's a book box, and I couldn't afford any books at the time, and so I only read what they left in the book box. So I read a lot of Football Manager's autobiographies, and
Dean Koontz,
some Dean Koontz, and some Jeffrey Archer. He's got some page turners.
Yeah,
yeah.
There is an art to writing. Yes.
Suspenseful
a book.
writing books.
Oh, come
on.
There's no art to it. It's just this and this and this
How
and this and this.
How many have you written now, Richard?
Oh, I wouldn't say what I've written in books.
Oh, I see.
But two things have been published.
Mm.
And there's another one that's about to
drop.
But yeah.
How many have you written? Right.
I'm just about to finish my second book.
Oh.
It's taken me ages.
Is it?
Not as long as Salinger.
What kind of thing is it?
I'm writing about men. But no, it's a massive topic. But this is why Catcher in the Rye, reading it now, having done the research I've been doing for 3 years, and just being so fascinated about evolutionary pressures on men. So looking particularly at kind of social status and sexual selection. But what's very interesting in kind of current times is I just think teenage boys are getting a huge amount of conflicting information about what is expected of them. And that's what Catcher in the Rye is about. It's about you're supposed to be very strong but not aggressive. You're supposed to be respected by people, and like this effortlessness that other people just manage to do it. You can be the most popular, sporty, attractive guy in the school without trying to be it.
Yes.
And just how difficult it is.
Mm.
I think it's a very difficult, actually, the male thing, the idea that you have to provide and protect. I think that in itself is a very odd position.
Yeah, people don't really think that too much anymore, though, do they?
And it's weird. The programme First Dates makes such a song and dance about men paying for dinner in heterosexual couples. When I was researching for my book, there's a huge amount of news stories about men who wanted money back after dates. Have you ever read any of these?
No way.
Okay, I'll send you some. I think it's really interesting.
That they felt there'd been an outlay and they ought to...
And often not a huge outlay. So there's one in Costa Coffee... And it was in every paper, Telegraph, Times, Daily Mail, The Sun, The Guardian, all the papers. A woman had written a blog with screen grabs of the messages. She'd met up with a guy on an app. They went to Costa Coffee.
Yes.
He said, "You want to come back to my house? I'm getting a Waitrose delivery." She said, "No." And then he, the next day...
Even though there was a Waitrose delivery.
And he said, "I'll cook for you. I'm having a Waitrose delivery." And she said, "I don't feel comfortable."
Gosh, you can't please them people.
Messaged her to say, "Well, maybe we'll have dinner another time, come on for dinner." And she said, "I didn't really think there was a spark." And he replied, going, "Well, fair enough, can I have the $380 back?" And she said, "I can give it to charity." And he said, "I'll decide how I spend my money." But it's really interesting in terms of the investments of dating, because there's this other thing.
But that was a story because he's an outlier. I mean,
he's an outlier, but the comments underneath, there are lots of people saying, why are men expected to pay on dates?
Okay.
And if the expectation is an investment into a relationship.
You know, my comedy wife, Jo Cornish, is, as I speak, promoting his film, The Kid Who Would Be King, and has done a lot of press. And people occasionally sort of jokingly needle me with it on social media. Look, Joe's got a film out. It's a proper film. What are you doing?
Oh my gosh.
What are you doing, Adam?
Well, I'm doing a podcast about Catcher in the Rye that just sort of meanders all over the place.
How dare you? They're going to type this up and put it in Sparks Notes.
But one of the comments I got was, what is Adam Buxton doing anyway? He seems to be content just to live his life out in the country with his brackets rich? Wife? i.e.
wow,
you know, yes, he's not doing anything to earn money because he's never been on TV that I can remember, so presumably he's just a kept man. And how humiliating to be living, you know, with his wife providing all the money. It's like that would be the most humiliating thing, to not only be inveterate and lazy and unsuccessful, but also to be paid for by a woman.
My dad was always ill when I was young, so my mum was always the person who bought everything. I just didn't find it strange. I'm more evolved, is what I'm saying.
So I
and
think
better than other people.
We've sorted everything, us three.
My primary caregiver, and my dad, who didn't live with us, was a jazz musician and who didn't have any of that macho status. So I found it very surprising as an adult that anyone cares or anyone thinks you should do anything just because of your gender.
Right.
I'm very evolved as well.
I think we've pretty realised that if Holden Caulfield were to like anyone, it'd be these three guys sitting right here.
I think,
here.
I think
Phony Club, not in it.
Had he not, we'd call ourselves Phony Club, ironically.
Yeah, exactly.
Because we're so unphony. I think if
Holden gets such a bang out of us.
If we'd actually managed to do this in 2009 before he died, I think he wouldn't
There'd
have
shot us. There'd be another 10 years.
when we did the pilgrimage.
I like the Phony Club. I'm also thinking of My Little Phony.
Oh, My Little Phony's
Please,
nice.
Come on. Don't throw that away. Don't just toss that away like it's like a small thing. That's like a major discovery.
That's really great.
What's Adam Buxton doing with his life? That's what.
Wordplay.
My Little Phony.
Yeah.
See yes. ya.
Wait.
This is an advert for Squarespace. Hey guys, it's Broshak with me, Paul Broshak. We got Mike here. We're going to talk about his new MMA comedy special. We're going to talk about his view counts, and we're going to talk about conspiracy theories. What's up, Mike?
Hello, Paul.
Hey, brother.
I'm fine, thank you. I don't want to talk about any of those things anymore.
You don't?
No. I want to talk about... I built a website, Paul.
All right, stream some fights, settle some beefs, stick it to the elites, that kind of thing.
No, it's mainly dog pictures, Paul. And I did it on Squarespace. Have you heard of Squarespace? I went to squarespace.com/Buxton and I did a free trial. And I tried some of the beautiful templates, Paul. And I typed things in. I dragged in pictures of the dogs. And before I knew it, I had a website, Paul. So I bought it and I've made some very sweet dog t-shirts. And I sell those on the shop on the website.
Uh-huh. But do you still fight and stuff?
A little bit, but not really. Oh, and Paul, I wanted to tell you that when it comes time to buy your website or domain on Squarespace, if you use the offer code Buxton, you save 10%. Paul.
Thanks, Mike. Where'd you do that free trial?
Squarespace.com/Buxton.
And how sweet were the dogs?
Very.
Continue.
A body. A body coming through the rock, you see.
Hey, welcome back, Podcats. That was Sarah Pascoe and Richard Iowade. I'm very grateful to them for their time. That conversation was recorded in February of this year, 2019. And at the time, they were both busy writing those books, which will be out later this year. Sarah's book, Sex, Power and Money, is published at the end of August. And there's a link to the Waterstone site where you can pre-order it. The site says, it's a funny book with serious intent. Sex, Power and Money asks uncompromising questions about the sex industry, objectification and the erotic allure of immense wealth. And in so doing, Pascoe offers a splenetic, incisive and frequently hilarious account of the modern condition. And actually, now that I think of it, it occurred to me that the thing I was talking about with Sarah at the end of that conversation, when I mentioned that person's comment about me having a rich wife, I perhaps took it the wrong way, and actually it wasn't intended to imply that having a rich wife would be humiliating. Maybe it was just innocent speculation, I don't know. As a matter of fact, I do have a rich wife. Rich in kindness, rich in love, and rich in omega-6. Richard's latest book is called Richard Iowade on Top,
It's out at the beginning of September 2019. And the blurb reads thus: at last, the definitive book about perhaps the best cabin crew dramedy ever filmed, View from the Top, starring Gwyneth Paltrow. Ayoade argues for the canonization of this brutal masterpiece, a film that celebrates capitalism in all its victimless glory, one we might imagine Donald Trump himself half-watching on his private jet's gold-plated flat screen while his other puffy eye scans the cabin for fresh young prey. That sounds like a bit of blurb that Richard would have written himself. I haven't read the book, but I do know that Richard has got this weird obsession with View from the Top, this film starring Gwyneth Paltrow. And so that clearly is the central motif for his new book. And I will be talking to Richard about that book and other things in September the 5th, I think it's a Thursday, at London's South Bank Centre. You will find a link to book tickets in the description of this podcast. This is going to be the last episode of the podcast that I put out for a little while. We'll be back in October, that's the plan, with more semi-regular episodes to take you up to Christmas. Rosie, come on, let's head back. Oh, this is a good flypast. That's the wrong way, though. Dog log, we're not going down that way. No, not that way either. We're going down that way. We're going back home. All right. It's time for a rest. We're on our summer break now. Sort of a summer break. Speaking of books, I've still got a lot to do on my stupid book. So I'm going to carry on trying to do that. And then by the time I speak with you podcats again, everything in the world will be fine. Trump, they will have got rid of Trump because, I mean, send her back, send her back. He's not going to survive that, is he? Of course he's not. No, it'll be fine. They'll get rid of him. I mean, it's beyond the pale. Him just standing there while the people at his rally are chanting, send her back. He's never going to survive it. Trust me. They'll get rid of him probably in a couple of weeks. Probably our great new Prime Minister will sort it out for us. So everything's looking up. Political. Okay. Thanks very much indeed to Annika Meissen for her edit work on this episode. Thanks to Seamus Murphy Mitchell for his production support. Hey, listen, I hope you get to enjoy some summer fun. If you miss the podcast while it's away, then explore the Adam Buxton app, where you will find bonus episodes not available in the regular run and links to some stupid videos and, I don't know, have a look around. The app is free. Okay, listen, tread carefully out there and bear in mind, I love you. Bye!